Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, how are you tonight?
Well, I'm on the phone, so I guess I can't complain too much.
Well, I'm really excited tonight, Red. You know, we've had some great guests on this show, especially in the last year. You know, Dr. Edwin Vieira and John Weaver and Robert McCurry and Elo Jones and Michael Donald. I mean, the list just keeps right on going. I mean, it's been pretty impressive, but I don't really remember being any more excited about having a guest on than Pat Shannon. You've been telling me about Pat for a long time. Of course, you guys have been friends for many years, and I really appreciate you sending me down his book too. And I've been reading that thing, and I just had this thought, you know, that in the last 3 or 4 years, all of the information that's been flying into my head, all the data that I've researched and all the things, that the lies that I've revealed and the propaganda that I've filtered through and dug into all this stuff, it's been almost more than I can even stand mentally for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. I mean, my mind's just about turned to mush. I can't imagine a guy like Pat and doing the investigative work that he's done for, what, 45 years? I mentioned this to somebody earlier today about the fact that if I was him, I mean, my mind would be mush. And, of course, this person that I was talking to, they've been involved in this battle for 20, 25 years themselves. And he said, well, your mind kind of goes to mush, and then it recovers, and then it goes to mush again. And it just kind of goes through that cycle. Have you had that kind of response, Red?
I never heard it described that way. Excuse me. But there's, the frustration that develops, and that's a product of your research and such frustration. And it kind of overwhelms you, and you think, well, boy, why am I doing this? We're a minority, and we've got to rub elbows with our fellow Americans, and they're just not up to speed with what's really happening to their country. And so it's frustrating, but we are gaining, and that's the most important part. We're gaining, and we're gaining very rapidly now.
Well, Red, I don't know. I don't see any sign that Pat's called in yet. He should be calling in here shortly. But could I ask you to open us with a prayer tonight?
I can do that. Heavenly Father, we come to you knowing that we really are so insignificant and so powerless because the enemy that is against us is so powerful. But when we team up with the Holy Spirit and God the Father, the Lord Jesus Christ, there is no greater power. And help us to comprehend what that really means. Before Christ ascended into heaven, he was giving his last instructions to his apostles, and he said, you're going to be called before the magistrates, and he said, don't worry about what you're going to say, because I'll give you the words. And I've experienced that over the past several years, or 20 years, I guess, where I've been given the words, and I'm totally dependent. And I'm sure that Terry is pretty much dependent upon that, too. And so, God, we just thank you, because you do let us come to you, petitioning you for your participation in this show tonight. We need your participation. We need your insights. We need you to guide us, and we just pray that we will be tools that you can use in this war against evil government. And bless Pat Shannon when he comes on tonight, and he's got a lot to say, and it's going to be a very good program, and we just thank you for it. And this program, we just commit it to you, dear Lord. It's yours, and use us as your tools to make it happen. We thank you for all you've done for us. Amen.
Amen. Well, I'm hoping Pat will jump in here. I've been looking for things in this book that surprised me, and there's been a few in his book that struck me. I wasn't aware that Abraham Lincoln had what, 1,200, or let's see, how many, I'm trying to think of how many political prisoners it was, but he rounded up a bunch of people, including 100 of the Maryland politicians when they were about to vote to secede. He went and rounded them up, and he held them in prison during the war. Rather interesting, some of the things that he brings out about Lincoln. I thought that was fascinating.
He suspended habeas corpus.
Right.
And that is a major no-no for public servants in this country. And he showed his true colors when he did that.
Yeah. Well, we've got a couple of callers on the line that have not raised their hands, and I just want to let anyone know that's called in on our call-in line that you need to hit a 1 to let the our producer, Dr. Kate, tonight, let her know that you want to speak or have an open mic. So if you would like to talk, make sure you hit a 1, please. Well, we got a number of people in our chat room tonight. Alaska's represented. Our buddy Alan from up in the Northeast is on with us. Chuck Kolb and the Dame Truth is in our chat room tonight also. So we just want to give a hello to all of those folks. And no one's raised their hand yet, so I'm hoping that Pat's going to call in here shortly. Give us a little bit of background on Pat.
Pat has had a pretty full life, and he's been a successful business person. He has been perhaps the highlight of his career was when the IRS raided him, and took all his records and everything. And of course, you see, that's a real, that tells us a lot. When the IRS doesn't like you to that extent, you're doing something right. And Pat has been very fortunate, and I think if we get to it on this program tonight, he'll tell about how he was charged criminally and spent 140-odd days in prison waiting for his trial, and he had quite a struggle deciding whether he should defend himself or whether he should get an attorney. And he decided that he would do it on his own. And he had a jury trial, and that jury came out and said not guilty on all counts. And so, this man has paid his dues. He has made a commitment, and he has a tremendous amount of talent in more ways than one. And so we're real fortunate to be able to get him on our program because he's a busy, busy fellow. He's about 70 now, if I remember right. And so he's got some good years in him yet, I'm sure. So I hope he shows up here. His prefix on his phone is 601. So if that helps, check, you know, his the call-ins.
If that will help. I appreciate that. And Kate's telling me she doesn't see anything on there yet. If we don't hear from him in a minute, I might ask you to maybe give him a call.
I'll call him in a bit. If I'll have to go get his number. I should remember it, but I don't trust myself too many times that way anymore.
All right. This has been an interesting week for me. I've been doing a lot of studying, a lot of digging. One of the things that's surprised me, Red, have you looked into, you know, what has been done with our calendars and how they've monkeyed with our dates and times and how that fits into the Bible prophecy? Have you looked at that at all?
I have, and there's no question but what they have tampered with it. And the spring, you know, when we change into the spring here in a few weeks now, that is the key date on the calendar we should be using. And it's a very fascinating story. And there's books out written by a number of different people on the subject. And so we probably need to get into that at some point. And, of course, we do want that minister from down in Texas that has been studying the different translations of the Bible, and he has come to the conclusion that the King James 11 Bible is the only one out there that has the accuracy to be really identified as God's Word. He's an archaeologist. He's a seminary graduate. He's a very, very sharp individual, and I had told him that I would like to have him on sometime. We'll get him, and this is part of the education that we all need in this country.
Well, Pastor Dwayne Moore, who's been on the show here in the last couple of months, is apparently quite a bit of an expert on that subject as well, and he was actually in the process of writing a book and on it, and ended up finding another group that had already done the work, and you can find them at Four Angels Publications. Four is in the number four, angelspublications.com. And so he ended up not publishing a book on it because he felt like they were already doing a superior job of it, and he'd just been referring people to that site. And I just thought while we had a chance there, I put that website, that link in our chat room. I'm believing that there might be a mix-up on the time that Pat might think the show starts, so I'm thinking that it might be a good idea for you to call him. I don't know if you...
I've only got the one line, so I'll have to cut myself off here, and then I'll call him, and we'll see if he's... got his time scheduled wrong somehow or other. He said he's Eastern time. Of course, you know, a guy like that, when he gets on a story, an investigation that's going on, it's hard to detract from, you know, the project that he's on. It's hard to drop it. You know, it's just not easy. So I'll call him. I have to use this line, and so it won't
no
take
problem.
Me long.
We'll
I'll try to get him.
Kate will watch for you when you come back on. Well, hello, Kate. How are you tonight?
Hey, Terry, how about yourself? I'm fine.
I'm doing
What's
very
going
good.
On?
So what have you got to report about Chaudhary or whatever's been going on with the Muslim march or whatever it is up there in Washington?
Well, I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard anything except what you passed along that I guess one of their major speakers canceled. The only thing that I know about it is just, you know, Louis Farrakhan is calling for our death, of course. And on our show last night, we had Pastor Manning with us, and it was a very interesting discussion about how Obama has not inspired black people to, you know, more graduations and, you know, jobs and so forth and so on. But he has inspired basically radical Islam around the world to revolt and to, you know, just cause uprising. And I think that Farrakhan and so forth feel empowered now. I don't think they have the numbers, and I think they can have something backfire very easily if they try to take this over or try to take us over. But so it was a dud. The only other thing I'd just like to announce is the Supreme Court will hear once again a case on Obama's eligibility tomorrow in conference without Sotomayor and Kagan there and without the excuse of standing. So it should be very interesting, and I ask for everybody's prayers to hope that these justices do the right thing here. We just don't know.
So you believe that Hemingway actually got them to truly recuse themselves?
Well, it was a motion to do so, and I was thinking that maybe the original problem was, of course, that it was a formal motion to begin with to recuse. They said it was, the Supreme Court labeled it a quote-unquote request, which requires that it come back. So they'll either have to come out and say the motion was denied and, you know, deny the whole thing. So we'll see. I have no idea, Terry. I must admit a year ago I might have had some faith, but I don't have any faith right now. I just think that the curtain is being pulled back on everybody that's involved in this scam, and it's huge. The other thing I'd just like to report is everyone should go to obamasgarden.com because the story of the century is right there, and you will understand that Obama never had any birth certificate right before the election, and we were being told that straight to our faces, but we didn't see it. It was right under our noses. So that's about what I have to report, and I do feel I should head back to the switchboard and look for the guest, if that's okay with you.
That'll be fine. Let me just tell the listeners. Go ahead, Kate. Do what you need to do. Let me
okay,
just tell the listeners
you.
that first of all, the standing issue, they've been rejecting without comment every case that's come to the Supremes before Sotomayor and Kagan were even present. And when you start looking into some things like if you want to go do some searches for Vatican Bank slush accounts and things like that, you'll find that they have found slush funds that includes Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, and it's been reported that he's got nearly $1 billion trust fund, not trust fund, but a slush account at the Vatican Bank. And when you start to recognize that the corruption reaches that kind of money and that kind of depth, you know, if you have any faith in what this Supreme Court will do or that they have any interest in doing anything to defend the Constitution or their oath of office, or any of us, for that matter, anything that would be to the public good, you're just, I'm sorry, but you're delusional. These people are absolutely corrupt to the core. They have bought off our judiciary all the way down to our county level. And it's just, I'm just totally beyond myself when I start to think about it, because I'm facing some issues even in the judiciary right here in Colorado. And we had, of course, Janet from Colorado on last week who gave us numerous reports of how she had run into the corruption right here in the state of Colorado. And, of course, we've had Lieutenant Commander the Jag Hunter, Walt Fitzpatrick, on our show here a couple of weeks ago. And he certainly told us about all of the corruption that's going on over in Monroe County, Tennessee. I would urge our listeners to really look into your local area and try your best to really get people to recognize that they need to clear the bench of these corrupt judges. It's we had a great effort here in Colorado. It is extremely difficult to vote a judge off the bench. They just seem to hit the let's see, 601 is live. Let me introduce
everyone.
Hey, it's
Pat Shannon here. Red Beckman says I should call you.
Yes, sir. Well, Red should be on with us here in just a second, Pat. I wanted him to be able to introduce you. We welcome you to the show. We're here at Walls in Our Minds, and we're just glad you made it. And I hope everything is well with you and your part of the woods tonight.
Yes, yeah, okay. Do you want me to call back in a little while after he's on?
No,
he's on with us right now.
Oh,
Red, how about giving your friend Pat Shannon a proper introduction?
Pat Shannon and I have been friends for 20 years, I guess, or more. And he's always been very, very busy. He's got a lot of energy. And he puts it into his work. He was just a freelance investigative reporter for a long time. And he would investigate these different things that were happening on his own. And then when he wrote stories, well, he would sell those stories. And so he's had a considerable amount of experience writing. And so when he wrote this book, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie, I'm sure that it pretty well flowed out the end of that pen, because most of these, or a good share of these lies that were told, he has personally investigated them in one way or another, and that qualifies him to write this kind of a story. And this book is a must read for every American. So with that, Pat, we'll turn you loose.
Well, thank you, old pal Red. I don't know where you want me to be turned loose. The book Everything You Told Me a Lie was actually inspired by the many, many assassinations and news media cover-up. It began for me back in, really, 1964, a few months after the Kennedy assassination, when I saw the cover-up with the questions being asked of the framing of Oswald. Was he really for real? And September that year with the Warren Omission report is when I became hooked. And I was a young man then. For the next 20 years or so, I was just kind of I was a amateur sleuth. But as the more of these situations that came down the pike with the Martin Luther King murder, and then 2 months later, the Bobby Kennedy murder, the attempted murder on George Wallace, all these things that came down, everything really stank as far as the facts versus the reported situation. I was just I was hooked for like 20 years, and by 1983, when the instigated federal murder of Gordon Call in North Dakota by U.S. Marshals, which was laid down in premeditated murder of a United States citizen, which he somehow escaped the trap. They tracked him down and killed him 3.5 months later on June 3rd, 1983 in Arkansas. The whole case, and I don't know how many of your listeners might be aware of that, but this is what hooked me totally. This is what made me become a professional writer as opposed to an amateur sleuth, because I was bursting open with all this information that nobody knew about, and I did. So that's where my real career started. I had to tell the truth.
Well, Pat, just give us a little rundown of what's in this book. How many different stories are there? And I think Terry he hasn't gotten the whole book read. He's got part of it read, and I think he needs to tell this audience what he has discovered already. Reading what he has. I had sent him a book. Yeah,
okay, go ahead. Well, if Terry is into it, Red, I would rather have him ask me what he's inquisitive about and how far along he is, and maybe I can expound from there.
Well, are you there, Terry?
I'm here, and I've got about 1,000 questions and I'd want to ask.
I was afraid of that, Terry.
should we leap right to the one? I have to tell you, I love the way you started the book out. First of all, let me just say it's a well written book. I mean, I have an appreciation for a book that flows, that you can get into and you can read it. It's got a good storyline kind of way to it, and it's just you put it out there in such a way that's very very easy to follow and. You know, when you start laying out the odds of some of these things, it just you have no choice but to face the truth. And I love the way you started out by challenging people and telling them if they're not ready to accept this stuff, that they just might as well go ahead and close the book up and sell it for half price to somebody that'll actually believe what it says.
Oh, so, I forgot I'd said that, but I remember that now. Yeah, you're right. I've reached a point in my life now, Terry, that I don't know how to say it. I mean, I just can't accept the fools. Just don't motivate me. If they are motivated and moving along the lines of what they've learned from news media and elsewhere, that I'm not motivated by their knowledge.
Well, I have to also concede that this book kind of embarrasses me a little bit. And the reason it embarrasses me, because it brings out such simple thought patterns, such logical little things that, you just ask yourself, why didn't I see that? Why wasn't I awake to that? Why did it take me until now and having to be hit upside the head with a 2x4 to break out of the box that I was brought up in? And you see the simplicity of some of the facts, and you go, well, it was just too simple. It was right there in front of my face, and I bought into this stinking lie that they've been telling me on one issue after another, and it's sort of embarrassing for me, to be honest with you, Pat.
Well, I know the answer to your self question, and that is you've had no other knowledge to base your own opinions on. You have only been led. By, first of all, public education, and, of course, the news media. And so what else could you know? So I don't blame people that are a generation as younger than I am who you really had no other knowledge to depend upon.
Well, let me just hit you with something.
Okay.
I haven't run into it in the book yet, so I don't know that it's there, but have you? It's really outside your book, so I'm curious because I know that there's a lot of things that are not in this book that you have in your head. You're telling what people can at least accept initially. But have you looked into the Scorzini deathbed confession, the article that was at the Idaho Observer some years back regarding the Bush family actually being George H. Scherf Sr. and George H. Scherf Jr. and their association with Tesla? Have you looked at that at all?
No. I know much of the Bush family background, but I do not. I regret to say I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, the deathbed confession.
Okay. Well, you're obviously very aware that H.W. Bush is one of the worst characters that we've got in our history in the last 50, 60 years.
Oh, I mean, certainly. He was probably at the scene November 22nd, 1963. He was one of two people and adults in American history, he and along with Richard Nixon, who could not remember where they were when John F. Kennedy was murdered. I talk about that in the book, but to me, I still have to laugh about this. What a joke that is. But since the pictures have appeared of him, very likely, to me it appears to be him, standing in front of the school book depository at the scene in Dealey Plaza, plus the fact that two witnesses I have who the night before said that he indeed was at Clint Murchison's house in Dallas, Texas on Thursday night, November 21st, 1963, along with Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover and so many other bigwigs in Washington, almost everybody who was not a Kennedyite was there, and George Bush being one. I have two witnesses. One was Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend, the other one being my CIA pilot contact, whom I quote throughout the book, Russell Bowen, both of whom said, and if I may be so crude, I don't think it's crude. I'm going to take it back because even bastard is a biblical term. But Russell Bowen said, well, I know where both the lying bastards were, and they were with me at Clint Murchison's house and on Thursday night at the party. So there's no, to me, I am convinced that both Richard Nixon and George H.W. Booth were on the scene in Dallas. Of course, Nixon had left on Friday morning before the assassination, but I believe that George Bush was still there. He was a CIA operative. He was not very recognizable at the time, pretty obscure character. But the pictures that we have seen blown up of him probably standing in front of school book depository are convincing to me because of I know so much about his background.
Well, Pat, let's focus on a specific subject. It's one of the early ones you hit in your book, and I think it's worth maybe you giving the people, our listeners, some background on the history of money, and then maybe if we can visit a little bit about democracy, the term democracy, a little bit. But if you could start out, you talk about the history of money in here, and I think it's worth. Worth letting the listeners to get your experience of that.
Well, today, the publish economist, every publication, everybody who wants to talk about money talks about solving the problem with the dollar. They talk about the currency. Nowhere in the Constitution can you find that the Congress is authorized to issue currency. Article 1, Section 10 has a magic 17 words that says, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin of tender and payment of debts. The currency, the Federal Reserve notes, all these things that came later, were a convenience matter by banks that allowed people to keep their gold and silver coin, the lawful money as defined in the 1792 Coinage Act, as a dollar being a measurement of gold, 25.8 grains of silver, or a measurement of silver, 371.25 grains of silver. These are the things that are deceptive in this system. So for convenience matters, one could put his dollar of gold or his dollars of silver in a warehouse bank and get a receipt. This receipt said he could redeem his money at any time. These were Federal Reserve notes later, after 1914, when the first Federal Reserve Bank opened. But prior to that, there was no inflation in America, like less than 1% up to 1913 when the Federal Reserve Act was passed. There was no inflation in this country because we had a solid money that could not be counterfeited. Did you know that counterfeiting was a capital offense at the founding of our country? If you got caught counterfeiting your money, you got the hangman's noose, brother. It was that serious. Now, come 1913, the passage of the Federal Reserve Act and the fraudulent fiat money that now began to be issued, they began to put out Federal Reserve notes. They promised from the beginning that the American currency would always be backed, 100% backed by gold and silver. This was a lie from the beginning because there was never any more than 40% of gold and silver in the warehouse banks in Fort Knox from the very first moment. So by the time 1963 came along, the Federal Reserve notes had so inflated, like not nearly what we're seeing today, but it was so inflated the obligations, I should say, of what the banks could redeem, that they decided they were going to have to renege on this deal. So they began to circulate within the system Federal Reserve notes that were not redeemable. If you will look at any Federal Reserve note in the 1934 series, which I hold in my hand, I keep in my wallet for coffee shop seminars all the time, up to 1950 series, they all said this note is a lawful money, is legal tender for all debts in public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at any Federal Reserve Bank or United States Treasury. Now, this was removed in 1963, so the current generation has never seen a lawful Federal Reserve note. Now, let us stop and think. Today, we still see these papers slipping around that say Federal Reserve note. It says on the top left corner, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Well, any sophomore law student can tell you that for any note to be a lawful note, it must have four integral parts. It must have a specified amount. It must have a due date. It must have pays with a bearer on demand, which is specified amount of due date. And I'm sorry, I'm getting lost because I don't have one in front of me. But in any case, none of these notes today are anything but a piece of paper. They're not bearable. They're not redeemable on demand. So in 1963, how conveniently, the week of John F. Kennedy's funeral, these began to circulate amongst the redeemable notes that said they were redeemable on demand at any Federal Reserve Bank or United States Treasury. Now, here we have pieces of paper purporting to be notes. They're not notes at all. They're nothing but tokens. These circulated for 5 years until 1968, June the 24th, 1968, when the banker's window slammed shut and said, we will no longer redeem the redeemable notes. It was a total renege on the United States government. Here we got notes, redeemable, lawful notes, that the government says, sorry, we don't want your business anymore. And they slammed the window shut. So since June the 24th, 1968, there really has been no lawful money circulating in the U.S. And for that reason, I maintain, as I say in the early portion of my book, you cannot have anything resembling taxpayers' money if all of it is created from nothing. It's all government money. We don't have taxpayers' money anymore today. It's all government money. And anything that you pay in to the IRS, whether they have claimed to be tax or as money, is nothing more than going, it's not funding anything. You can check me out, but it's only going down into the federal sewer. So you've caught me strictly on giving a seminar totally unarmed without any notes in front of me, but that's the best I can do at this point. Please ask me another question before I get confused again.
Well, let's stay on this one for a minute because
All right.
we've talked a lot on this show about the banksters and how that the fractional reserve banking system and how corrupt it is and derivatives, and we've also mentioned that the IMF at this point is trying to do away with the Federal Reserve notes, even as the reserve currency for the world. They're looking at trying to do what they call SDRs, or special drawing rights, and how that they're trying to put a value on those special drawing rights based on a basket of currency, which for the most part is nothing but fiat. So they're taking a fiat and trying to value it based on a basket of fiat.
Right.
Now, let's come back to what you were talking about with the Kennedy's executive order, where he started actually having the Treasury. Those were actually redeemable silver certificates that Kennedy started having the Treasury issued were actually issued on the Treasury, were they not?
Well, see, I didn't mention that. I mentioned that the Federal Reserve notes were issued during his veto. This is one of the deceptions that's been going on for the last 50 years. In 1914, when the first Federal Reserve Bank opened, they had Federal Reserve notes, lawful notes that were redeemable in gold or silver coin, which was lawful money. And once again, the top left-hand corner said this note is legal tender for all debts in private and is redeemable or at any Federal Reserve Bank or the United States Treasury. This was a Federal Reserve note. It wasn't a service certificate. When the gold certificate, all these things were separate. But my point is today they still have what they purport to be Federal Reserve notes that are nothing but tokens. And once again, a note must have, to be a lawful note, must have four integral parts. It must have a specified amount. It must have a due date. It must have the other things that apply that I don't have in front of me now. But the note to be lawful was lawful at the time it was issued. The problem was the Federal Reserve was issuing so many of these paper notes that were outrunning inflation, that far more than they could redeem, that by the time 1963 came along, or even the 1950s when they began to realize it, they could never redeem these notes for gold and silver coin because they didn't have enough in the Treasury. So this is when they began to issue these unlawful notes, these tokens, this trash, in 1963 that said this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Didn't even have a period. It stopped there. This became a token that circulated amongst the lawful notes until 1968, and then they slammed the door shut and began to not redeem anything at all. So suddenly, the paper token became the entity. The $1 note or the $5 note or the $50 note became the dollar, became the entity rather than the receipt for the gold and silver that was in the warehouse. This allowed the system to steal the money from the people. To further that, and it's all in my book, and you've probably seen the piece about Merrill Jenkins, who was in St. Louis in 1959, was the real wizard on gold on. I'm trying to what do you call them? Cigarette machines and coin token machines and anything that involved putting dimes and nickels and quarters in the machines and newspapers and whatever. He was the wizard who had developed these and had the largest company in St. Louis. He got a visit from United States Treasury agents, who from the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, and they came to see him and asked him, said, what would it take to counterfeit these coins? Well, he thought he was doing a great red, white, and blue favor by pointing out to these U.S. United States Treasury agents what it would take, and he explained to them this, that, and the other. We'd have to have a very specific weight to do this, that, and the other. And he didn't realize until 1965, when the U.S. Treasury came out with the new slugs that had eliminated silver from their coins and put in phony slugs that contained nothing really of value, nothing like silver coins. And he realized that he had been hoodwinked. He had been the one to teach the U.S. Treasury how to counterfeit the coin from the people, and that's when that was stolen from us as well.
Well, you know, Red and I talk a lot about counterfeit on here, on this show. And Red keeps pounding it into me, and he's finally got it where it would sink in, that Satan has no creative ability. All he can really do is counterfeit God's actions. And so he has a tendency to do that. And our currency is probably just a good image of that, because all we have is counterfeit. And when people recognize that all that they've got is counterfeit, and that they've just been duped into believing that it's something of value, I think that maybe helps them recognize how this whole thing is unfolding and beginning to, it's just a house of cards that's about to collapse in on itself.
Well, right. Red and I have talked about that in the past, and, of course, he has great, great insight on the biblical indications of what's happening in our world today. And I agree with him. I mean, Red and I disagree about a very few things, but he has a great ability to delve into it. And certainly what we are experiencing today with the counterfeit money could not be more, could not more exemplify what he means about what Satan's ability to counterfeit when Satan has no ability to create. That's exactly what's happening here.
Well, you mentioned solutions. Even when you were talking about democracy defined, you really covered a lot of good points in those couple of pages in the foreword to your book. I really enjoyed your foreword a lot. But you get into talking about the need to get back to a constitutional currency. And this is a point that I bring out frequently. As a matter of fact, I believe, in all honesty, Pat, that it is one of the first things that we have to do within each state if we expect to ever get our constitutional republic back. If it's going to happen, we've got to cut off the vortex that has been created by these banksters that is basically sucking the life's blood out of our economy and everything else. I mean, it's stealing the wealth of the middle class is the best way for me to put it. But they have it set up in the system so that there's just this vortex that sucks everything into it. And the only way to stop that vortex is for the people to regain proprietary ownership in a constitutional sound currency. And the only way for us to accomplish that is for the states to build a barrier by putting legislation in place, by making it lawful for us to have gold and silver as our legal tender in our state, and they need to include forcing by electronic gold transfer or some means of similar of a payment of some taxes in that way, starting out so that it competes with the existing system. If we don't get that done, none of the other things that we're trying to accomplish as far as judicial reform or getting them to actually rewrite the rules of procedure so that common law presentments can be enforced. You know, none of those things are going to be doable as long as that vortex exists and we have a police state at the federal level that can come in and crush the individual if we try to do any kind of barter that's outside of their corrupt taxing system.
Well, right on. And let us remember, let us always remember that the police state that wants to crush anything that we do, they're almost always crushing honesty and truth. And you know, the Constitution was laid out so plainly, so honestly, that, by the way, I wish you would remove from your vocabulary, and I say that with all due respect, because obviously you are one who's you're after truth. But I wish you would remove the word currency, because nowhere in the Constitution was Congress allowed to create currency. Congress was allowed to coin gold and silver. That's lawful money. The currency came along later by the banksters. It was a convenience thing to print paper. And as long as you've got money in our bank, we'll give you this receipt for it. We'll call it currency in a Federal Reserve note and blah, blah, blah. But that allowed in the depravity of man. And I don't care what kind of schemer wants to come up with this sort of thing, with United States notes or anybody else wants to come up with this, that, and the other. If you cannot eliminate the depravity of man, you are not going to solve anything. You're only going to have another criminal taking care of the paper instead of the Federal Reserve Bank. They want to eliminate the Federal Reserve Bank and blah, blah, blah. But if we don't get back to gold and silver coins circulating, this is what removed the depravity of man, because the feds could not counterfeit gold and silver. And this is what it took them 125 years to 1913 to figure out. We got to get the Federal Reserve in here. We're going to hoodwink the people and believe in this is going to do this, that, and the other. And this is what allowed them to take over and overrule, very surreptitiously, I might add, the Constitution of the United States. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin to turn to payment debts. Instead, we will be able to make it federal money. We will create it over here in Washington, D.C. We will circumvent the Constitution and the state's rule, and we will issue this and force them to use what now has amounted to, as anyone should be able to see if they will do a little history, counterfeit money. We have been operating on counterfeit money since literally 100% counterfeit since June 24th, 1968, when the banks refused to redeem any Federal Reserve notes for lawful money, gold and silver coin. We have been 100% inflationary since then. So democracy is a farce. We were never supposed to be a democracy. Anyone who had any experience at the time, John Adams, all the rest of them are quoted in there, that democracy was doomed. And when it looks at today, we'll know that democracy means mobocracy, and 50.1% and direct the other 49.9% into doing anything against God's laws or anything moralistic or anything you were brought up to believe in. A democracy is doomed and will never succeed. And that is what has been sold to us for the last century in this country. And we must get off of that the terminology. They've changed the language on us, and that's one of the main words they've changed.
Indeed. Well, can we jump over to your most controversial topic in your book?
Would that be the moonwalk?
Sure would.
Yeah. Well, I expected it to be, but you know, certainly we can. But you know, I was surprised the last 3 or 4 months since my book appeared that I have gotten nothing but public support on that. I really expected people to jump all over me on that one. And I have a friend, an acquaintance at least, in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and he saw my book that appeared to the publicity in the American Free Press, and he said, "I want 20 copies." I said, "What in the world are you going to do with 20 copies? You haven't even read it yet." He said, "Well, I saw the title, and I saw that you had written it, and that was good enough to me, and I want to give it to my grandkids." So I sent him 20 copies. And 2 weeks later, he gives me a call, and he said, "I want to tell you something, Pat." He said, "When I saw your book, and I appreciate you autographing one for me, and I thumbed through it, and he said, as I went to each chapter, this, that, and the other, I agreed with you on everything, except," he said, "you know, I would have argued with you all afternoon about Armstrong walking on the moon until I read your facts." And he said, "You know, they really didn't go, did they?" And I said, "No, they didn't, Howard. They really didn't go." But he said, "Well, you convinced me. I've never seen anything like this before. So go ahead. Let me hear your questions."
Well, I read it, so I'm wondering what you didn't say. Tell me more about this guy who got punched.
Once again, I don't have the book in front of me. Seibel. Yeah, Bart Seibel.
Yes, right.
Well, he went on a mission about 10 or 15 years ago now. He learned the basics of this from the other people I mentioned, especially Ralph Rene, who was a friend of mine before he died back in 07 or 08. And Ralph really had kind of sprung open the doors on this whole fraud enough for Bart Seibel to want to know about it. And Bart had invited Ralph and others to a seminar and learned what he could. But Bart's a new regime. He's the young Turk. And he went to see various people, and he took the camera with him. And he's got a lot of courage. I admire him for what he did. But one of the people that he interviewed, along with most of the astronauts who went before, but he first went after Armstrong and Aldrin. And Buzz Aldrin, as I mentioned in the book, had a lot of problems in the 70s after the so-called moonwalk in 69. And I don't know, it appears to us that he just had a lot of heartache. He just had a lot of depression. He became a falling down drunk in the gutter. By the 1980s, though, he became a born-again Christian. He resolved all that. And in the 90s, when Bart Seibel had come along and was pursuing it as an investigative reporter, he found out that Buzz Aldrin was speaking at some kind of hotel meeting, and I think it was downtown Los Angeles. Seibel was there waiting for him, met him in the lobby, and said, "Mr. Aldrin, would you swear," once again, don't forget, we're talking to an alleged born-again Christian. He said, "Mr. Aldrin, would you put your hand on the Bible and swear that you walked on the moon in 1969? Well, this born-again Christian instead takes a swinging punch and punches Seibel right in the left cheek. He doesn't knock him down, but he backs him up and walked away, gave him a little cursing, I think, but that was it. So the same thing happened similarly when Seibel confronted Armstrong. Armstrong was absolutely speechless. Now, I've seen these on video because Bart was smarter to have others filmed. And Armstrong was absolutely speechless for 10 or 15 seconds when Seibel had simply asked him, "Would you put your hand on the Bible and swear that you've been to the moon? If you will, I have a check here for $5,000 that I will make payable to you or your favorite charity if you will just tell us that you really swear that you walked on the moon." Armstrong was speechless. He said nothing for several seconds and finally walked away. And this has been the same situation with everyone. Now, my point has been in the book, as you read, that if we are here are talking about the greatest historical feat since Jesus Christ walked on the water 2,000 years ago. I mean, here's a man, Lindbergh went to across the Atlantic, for goodness sakes, in 1927, and he was a hero for the rest of his life. He had thousands and thousands of people who greeted him at Orly Field in Paris, and he had a parade in New York City when he got back. I mean, this was an absolute American hero, a world hero. And here we've got a guy that goes to the moon, and he is a recluse. No one ever hears him publicly speak. To me, he should be as big as Thomas Jefferson or Christopher Columbus walking around, and he's a recluse. I think he's ashamed, not because he pulled this off, but because of what he was forced to do to pull off himself. He was forced to be a false hero, and I think he's ashamed of himself.
Well, in your book, you mentioned about the Russians and how they knew full well that that the whole thing, the moon thing, was a farce, and how they were really way ahead of us, and that they basically were laughing at us through the entire affair. And I think if we if they were to try to pull something like that today because of the internet, we would have been able to get that news that was coming out of Europe and Russia sufficiently that we would have been informed about it. But at the time, they were able to control it because the people here were so dependent on the television sets, and they controlled, of course, what was the information that was coming out of that. And I really like your dedication in your book, by the way, too, to the investigative reporters who still go out there and continue to try to report the truth, even though they know full well that it'll never make it to the public.
Yeah.
If you could elaborate more on what the world knew at the time and maybe how they kept us in America from getting the truth.
Well, you're speaking of initially of the Cornell professor, James McCanney, and he was the one who learned the stuff from the Russians that I later wrote about in the book. And I have a couple of radio interviews with him where I had recorded and listened to his absolutely. He's so flabbergasted. He was like I was, except I was hoodwinked for about 20 years. McCanney was hoodwinked for only about 10 years. And that's because around 1979 or 80, he had begun to work on some other projects with Russian scientists, and that's when they began to laugh at him. And so he laughs at himself now as he researches it and realizes, of course, while the Russians had done 12 to 1,600 moon shots, or I should say space shots, when we were doing one or two or three a year, that we were led to believe was a big deal. And indeed, we still do have the suppression, by the way, with the American news media. The difference being, of course, as you mentioned, the news media, we get to learn more from the sidelines, but the American people don't. The American people still learn only what comes across their TV, the masses. I'm talking about the great 80 or 90% unwashed. They learn only what comes across the TV and the evening news and the Associated Press in the morning. So, indeed, McCanney was blown away. But he also, as an intellectual college professor, was smart enough to discern that he had been hoodwinked. And he was seeing the facts now versus the Bravo Sierra that he had succumbed to the first 10 years or so after the fact.
Well, can you elaborate and let some of our listeners know a little bit about the Van Allen radiation belts?
Oh, golly. You know, that to me was probably the most solid piece of evidence that it was impossible to go. And this is what my friend, my late friend Ralph Rene, had determined way back, told 20 years ago now, when he began to write. The Van Allen belt was discovered by a professor who had been working with NASA, Professor Van Allen from the University of Iowa, back in 1958. And they had sent up some shots up there after Sputnik in 57 had allegedly made us behind in the space race, that they had done some satellite shots and stuff through the what became a radiation belt, and Van Allen had determined as early as 1958 that there's a few hundred miles of radiation up there that you simply cannot go through without being radiated to a point of death. And I think the Russians understood this. You remember when the Russians were sending up monkeys? But for the simple reason, they were smart enough not to endanger the lives of their own astronauts. So they would send the monkeys up there. We heard about monkeys coming back, but we never heard about how long they lived, if you remember. Well, this was a situation with that Van Allen, Professor Van Allen, discovered. That you can't go through there without some kinds of protection. Well, meanwhile, a year or two or three later, down the road in the early 60s, they determined it for a rocket ship to go up through the Van Allen belt, it would have to be encapsulated with like a 1 foot or more thick shield of lead, which in turn would make it so heavy that it could never leave Earth in the first place. So it would never get off the ground in Cape Canaveral. And so it really was a catch-22 from the beginning. And in my opinion, after that, everything else just became propaganda, Bravo Sierra, for the next several years, even after President Kennedy said we're going to get a man to the moon by the end of the decade. It was an impossibility. The astronauts knew it, and there also is great speculation that Gus Grissom, the astronaut, one of the three who died on the strip there in January of 67, I believe, was probably, well, I should say not probably, but at least likely, could have been suspect at least, murdered, intentionally killed because he was a whistleblower. And that's in the book as well.
Yeah. Well, I know that one of the scientists or physicists determined that in order for a craft to even travel the distance, even if those belts weren't there, even if that radiation didn't exist, that the craft would have had to been like something like 266 times the size of what they sent up in order to simply make the trip, to make the voyage.
Right. Yes.
You know, things like that. I've been to the Space Museum, Air and Space, the museum there off of the mall right down from the Smithsonian. Of course, Smithsonian, they control that. And I saw the limb, you know, that's there. And the first thing that struck me was that, wait a second, this thing's too small.
And you saw this before you read my book?
Yeah.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad to hear that because you noticed it too.
You know, they couldn't have got in and out of that thing with their tanks and those suits, much less put a lunar rover, one of those rovers. Where the heck would they have put that in that thing?
Well, this is what Jim Collier pointed out, was that they couldn't get the door shut with their packs on.
Well, I just commend the way that you put this book together. What's coming out in volume two? Can you give us a hint? I'll tell you the one question that I've got for you. I've got a zillion other questions, but I've got one question I need to ask before we get too far in the show.
Okay.
And that is, what's the most recent thing that has surprised you?
The most recent thing that has what?
That has surprised you. That kind of caught you flat-footed. What just kind of slapped you and the light bulb went off and you went, now how did I miss that? That's what I want to hear.
Wow, you've caught me by surprise. But the most recent would be an article I just wrote today of Lindsay Williams explaining what's really going on in the Middle East. And he has gone public just in the last week explaining several things about the OPEC and the agreement with Kissinger in as far as, I mean, he's talking about 30 years ago, and this is not anything hot news because, indeed, do you know who Lindsay Williams is?
Sure.
Okay.
I've listened to a number of his interviews on Alex Jones, including the one last Thursday.
Okay, well, that's what I'm speaking of. So when you said most recent, that would be probably the most recent revelation because, to me, that pulled together so many pieces of the puzzle of what is going on. And, you know, we can never trust what politicians say. When he pointed out, he reminded us, I should say, that 30 years ago he told us about Henry Kissinger's agreement with OPEC and the Middle Eastern nations to, I'm going to pull this thing up while we talk, but to give you some better details on what's in my memory. But when he pointed out that, and I remembered it from his book, that he'd been talking about it for 30 years, that Henry Kissinger came to terms with the Middle Eastern oil-rich nations, agreeing that the U.S. would make them wealthy beyond their wildest dreams, he said, by buying their oil. And although the U.S. has enough oil in Alaska alone to last us 200 years, we would agree then to leave it lay and produce but a pittance of oil in this country. Now I'm quoting from my story that's going to be in American Free Press next week, but I want to go on to say that in return they were to take a portion of their income from oil sales and buy our debt by purchasing treasury securities, T-bills, and other credit paper. This is not new information, but something Williams reported three decades ago. The new information, and now he has gone public with it, is that the elite are about to renege on the deal and double-cross those nations and OPEC, and it is all about furtherance of the New World Order. Now, Williams explains that the current crisis was initiated by the CIA using paid agitators in Egypt, creating the crisis now spreading to the entire Middle East. Although they did not initiate these current events, the Muslim Brotherhood is being supported by the elite in the crisis areas in the aftermath. Once Iran and Saudi Arabia fall, oil will soar. Now he goes on to explain that between the ongoing crisis and the continued decline of the fiat dollar, we must always refer to it as fiat dollars. I said that, he didn't. Oil will go to $150 to $200 a barrel before the year is out. That's 2011. When it reaches these levels,
we can see it gradually going, just like he said. And I heard his prediction of that back 3 months ago.
Yes, about
4 months ago, and it's been doing exactly what he said. Again, it comes back to recognizing that oil really is the international currency, and it has been for a long time, and that these same banksters, these international banksters that control our Federal Reserve, that are in these elite bloodlines, these are the same people that control the oil bourse, and that, you know, people think that there's just a normal competition of oil pricing out there and that they manipulate it somewhat, but that's really a short of what the truth is. The truth is they set those prices, and you know that's how those prices are done. They're fixed. They're not. There's really not a normal competition in that pricing, and they've manipulated the Saudis up and down. They brought the price down to break the Saudis, and now they've held off on disclosing the reserves like the Bakken and Gull Island and Prudhoe Bay and all of that, and now they've waited so long to get the infrastructures into place to produce out of those that it's going to take us, what, 5, 7, 8 years to really be able to produce our own oil. So they've made it so that even once the, you know, they have all this turmoil and they make it so that we can't get any oil from the Arabs, and we can't get it from the Russians because the Russians have made an obligation to the Chinese to supply them first, that once they start producing here, it's going to take us some time to get that infrastructure in place. So it's going to take, you know, at least 7 years. Where do we hear the 7 years come from?
Go ahead.
I'm referring back to Bible prophecy at this point. And the tribulation. I mean, it all fits together when you start studying all these facts. I mean, even the scripture supports what seems to be coming. And so even if we start producing tomorrow, it's not going to benefit us for years to come, is my point.
How long it will take to put this in place is kind of arbitrary because we don't know how long they've already been at it. Are they ready to go? Will it take them only 6 months or a year to put it in place? We don't really know that. But the fact that this double-crossing is going to be taking place makes perfect sense to me because the U.S. government has always double-crossed people. It's just like the same way it double-crossed us in 1968 when they refused to accept our Federal Reserve notes for silver coin anymore.
For the benefit of our listeners that are not in our chat room, that are just listening, you can get information. You can actually see some of the Alex Jones interviews with Lindsey Williams. You can actually hear them if you go to Dr. Kate's View at WordPress.com. That's Dr. Kate's View. .wordpress.com. You can also see her interview and with or hear her interview with Reverend Manning on Revolution Radio from tonight. But the interesting thing to me about Lindsey Williams, and I don't know if you bring this out in your article, is that so much is a distraction, and that we have to keep our focus and recognize that the real crux of what's going on is happening between Russia and China, that even what's going on in the Middle East is to some extent a distraction of what's happening with Russia and China.
Right. And I am so restricted by words in American Free Press anymore that I read that and I considered that, but I decided that might be a whole different article. So I didn't really allude to it except to point out that if the end game is to bring the U.S. into the New World Order, as Williams claims, then much has been already accomplished toward that goal by shipping jobs and factories overseas and further weakening our money. China will replace the U.S. as a world power, and the renminbi will no doubt replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency, is actually my closing paragraph.
Interesting. Red, you've been awfully quiet.
Yeah, there was no need of me speaking up because you fellows were doing right well keeping this thing moving. I would like to switch just a little bit back to in the beginning of the book, not right the bare beginning, but there's a short rundown there of Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah.
And That got my attention because I had written in one of my books about Ronald Reagan that I didn't buy into the major media and such what they were saying. Ronald Reagan, they have made a saint out of him in this country, and.
Mm-hmm.
When you know the facts, he was, what was it? He tripled the national debt in his terms there, two terms. And it just, you tell people that and they just can't hardly believe it.
Well, Red, you know, he outspent all 39 presidents that preceded him all total.
Mm-hmm. But I was so glad to see that because it just, like I say, they've made a saint out of him, and he was not a saint. And, you know, I'll argue the point, and it really, it's a lie that really needs to be exposed.
Well, as I point out, he probably epitomizes the title to my book as well as anyone, because he was really sold to us. He was a media package, Red. I think now as I read back and see history and stuff, he might have been, I'm not sure he was, I can't say that he really was, but he might have been sincere in his transference from liberal Democrat to conservative Republican. But as far as his beliefs went, I went too far then. He really wasn't a conservative Republican. But he might have been sincere in at least escaping the Rooseveltian left-wing stuff. But his actions as California governor proved that he really never was a conservative. But I believe that he was brought in by the bigger package in 1980 to position George Bush. George Bush could never have been elected president, and Ronald Reagan was very, very sellable to the American people. And I think the activities of March the 30th, 1981, when they shot him, he somehow survived. But he at least got the message. He got the visit from the boys in the dark glasses and the trench coats a couple days later, and I think Nancy was probably sitting there. I think they both got the message that, hey, boy, you're not president. George Bush is our president. You are going to be the figurehead. George is the boss. Now sit up and take a lesson or die. That's what I think happened.
I think I would agree with that because there was something really, really fishy, and you bring out a lot of that in your story there about Reagan. Hinckley was his father was a very close friend of George H. Bush.
Yeah, what are the odds of that?
Yeah. And the media, they had to know about it, but they sure didn't tell the American people about it.
Well, except for John Chancellor, he slipped up the first night. If you remember,
yeah,
he announced that Scott Hinckley and Neil Bush happened to have a dinner date that evening.
Yeah. Yeah. It just we all know that we have not been told the truth about hardly anything in our lifetimes. And, of course, I've had a little more life than most of, our audience out there.
Yeah, you're about 130, aren't you?
What?
You're about 130, aren't you?
I feel that way. I think confronting the people, the American people, with this in a book, like this, those lies come at us one at a time, and we absorb them, and we say, I can't do anything about it, and then a few months later, here comes another one.
And they forget about it. Yeah.
By putting them all in these books, it bunches them up to where you can see that these are all major happenings in this country, and they were all lies. Back when I first got involved in traveling and speaking out in the 70s, I would challenge audiences. I would challenge them right in the beginning of my presentation, and I would say, we all know that they lied to us about Social Security and energy shortage and Watergate and Kennedy assassination. They lied to us about all those different things. And
I remember you writing about that. I remember that very well.
Yeah. Anyway, over the years, I did that. I've still done it, you know, in recent times, challenge an audience, and I have never had anybody that came forward and said that I was wrong. Never have I had, because subconsciously, I think the American people know that they've been hoodwinked, they've been the victims of a planned conspiracy or whatever. And when you bring this out to them, they have to you know, pay attention and recognize that they themselves, you know, recognize that there was something wrong with all of these stories, that things just did not add up. And when things like the murder of Vince Foster, you know, that's kind of an insignificant story when you compare it with the Kennedy assassination and such. But, you know, there's some really, really poor investigative work by the investigators, the cops. And you have to wonder, you know, what they were paid to keep their mouth shut or what. Because the whole thing was as phony as could be.
Well, they certainly were paid.
Why?
They certainly were paid. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I have stood where that body lay of Vince Foster, you know, with his hands across his chest, and then to assume it was suicide is just absolutely ridiculous. But excuse me for interceding. Please proceed with your point because I interrupted.
Well,
we
have a caller.
I
got a question. You want to get him in?
These lies, like the Vince Foster thing, they're not that big, but they just you know, show what they will do. These conspirators will do when it's necessary to their cause. It doesn't make any difference. They can neutralize the media and the law. Peace officers and all the rest of them, and they do it and they get away with it.
I think you said we had a caller, Rick.
No, I
yes,
don't.
Yes, we do. We do. We you want to take a call? Area code 204. You have a live mic. Area code 724.
724 is me.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Dwayne Moore. How you doing, Terry?
I'm doing great, Dwayne.
Good to hear you. Listen, Pat, I'll address your guest. Pat, I've been handing out your information, the stuff you did on the Oklahoma City bombing. I'll pass
it out. Oh, good. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it.
I was passing out in video form before they had DVDs, so doing the real-time VHS recording copies was a real chore, but you were worth it. So
thank you.
I want to hand it to you for all the work you did in that one. I was in Huntsville in 74, and even as a youngster at that time, I was just fresh out of high school, I looked at the lunar landing module, if I could get back to that for a moment, and I stood there and stared at that, and I said, you know, I knew about the radiation in space, but I thought, you know, I must just be too dumb to think, and this is before I knew about the Van Allen radiation belts, but I said, I must just be too dumb, because I thought that there was like hundreds of times more radiation in space because of our magnetic force field keeping it away from Earth. Now, mm-hmm. They spent all that time up there, and I'm looking at the lunar landing module, and I'm like, you'd think that it wasn't much thicker than a beer can. How did that protect these guys? I didn't see any lead. And then you look at it, and it's like, I don't think that could withstand like 30 feet below the water's surface on planet Earth's ocean, let alone a negative pressure out in space. So I'm glad you're bringing this stuff to light. Although I think it was what Ronnie Strong and some of their guys have a two-disc video set on a lot of that stuff as well. But my question to you is, have you done enough research that you could do an entire book on just that? How much evidence material do you have?
Oh, well, as I said in the book, my first enlightening was Bill Kaysing's expose back around mid-'80s. And don't forget, I was as duped as everyone else. I mean, John McCanny at Cornell University, he only was duped for 10 years. It took me about 20 to figure it out. And, of course, I never did really figure it out. I was just enlightened by other people. And Bill Kaysing's book was first. He said we never went to the moon. And like most of the introductory investigated pieces, like Who Killed Kennedy by Thomas Buchanan back in 64, it didn't have many answers. It just had so many questions. And this is the way Kaysing was. He just didn't believe it, and he showed why he didn't believe it, and it was enough to intrigue me. Then when the real investigators, the scientists, the engineers came along, right, like Ralph René and the others I mentioned in the book, talking, and the photographic experts, and they're pointing out the shadows on the moon, the footprints in the soil where there's no moisture. I never would have thought of that. And of course, the one thing that did bother me, these clowns jumping in their suits are jumping up a foot or two high. I knew from the sixth grade or somewhere along that line that the gravity on the moon was 1/6. So anybody that could jump 4 feet high, which I could do at about the sixth grade, could jump 24 feet on the moon. I remembered that from a kid. And right. Here, there was something wrong with these pictures. So I only began to put it together to my own satisfaction by reading the other experts. What was your question?
Well, have you had enough information to put a book together?
Oh, no, I don't really have enough information, but I think there's enough information out there for someone to do a book. Absolutely. Because when I began to research my facts, because I don't mind having an error in opinion. You know, if I'm screwed up, if I predict the wrong thing, this and the other, that's just me. But I do not like to have an error in fact. And that's why I track this very closely on the Internet. You'll see most of the people, most of the facts I have in there on the moon and the other topics are research done by other people. And I just pulled up the stuff to satisfy myself that this is what happened. And today I believe that indeed those three guys went up in that rocket ship as we saw them in July of 1969. I believe they came down 23rd or 24th of July after the fact, and then they landed in the Caribbean or wherever it was. But I don't believe they ever got above 200 or 300 miles. I think they circled the Earth in orbit, and they came down on when they were on command, and all the pictures and everything we saw probably were done at Area 51 in Nevada, and everything else. To me, the pieces fall together, but it, certainly there's plenty there to do a book. I don't want to do a book about it, but there are other books about it already, and there's, yeah, absolutely. If you want to do a book, there's plenty of information out there on the Internet and elsewhere.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me that when you also understand that every astronaut has to be a 33rd degree Freemason to get there, you understand why now, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure if that's how they got to be the astronauts where they were, but I certainly understand that's why they are able to stay quiet.
Yes, exactly. They understand the consequences because of the seriousness of their secret society oath. So,
yeah.
Well, as I
said in the book, I just would love to see one of them just break out from that. Somebody like Armstrong, you know, all of them are 80 years old or thereabouts right now. One should come forward. If he has any real Christian honesty about him at all, I know the pressure's been on him in his lifetime. I know what they can do to threaten him with their kids and their grandkids, but.
Right.
I would certainly like for one of them to come clean, if nothing else, to have it published after his death.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Pat. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Dwayne, you're always welcome here. You know that. We were talking about you earlier. Dwayne, did you hear me talking about you earlier regarding the calendar?
I got on late, so I have to apologize. I was on another show, but go ahead.
Well, at the beginning of the show, before Pat came on, we were talking about how messed up our calendar is, and I gave him the site there at the Four Angels, which do you want to give that a plug regarding the books and videos?
Well, sure. You can catch my book, which is a shorter version, at assemblypost.com, which is, of course, we want to plug that as well. That's our New Republic people. But there's on that post, you go to Education and Study, and then there's a drop-down menu that has Yahweh's calendar, YHWH's calendar, and you can find my book there. But another fascinating read, which might be more fascinating for people that would be interested in the secret society aspects of the secret way that they switched calendars on us, you could go to a friend of mine, Laura Lee Bornholt Jones, and I think it's at fourangelspublications.com. And let me see. Yeah, the numeral four, angelspublications.com. And her book is called Calendar Fraud. Her and her mother, Elaine Bornholt, wrote that, I guess, about 2 years ago. They were on my show, so it was fascinating for me to hear that stuff. But those are the two places.
Well, thank you very much, Dwayne. And again, you're always welcome here. You know that.
Thanks, Terry.
Pat, you haven't. Yes.
I think Pat should give his address and how the people can get the book, and then give it one more time at the end here, because we're in the last half hour now. And
you took the words out of my mouth.
I think Pat should give his, how to get the book, because I hope we've got a lot of people out there that are going to want this book because of what we're saying here tonight.
Okay, ready?
Yes.
Pencil and paper's handy. If you will send $2 of lawful money, we got a $2 book here, folks. However, that's $2 of pre-1965 silver coin, U.S. coin. You may send that, or you may send $30 of counterfeit Federal Reserve notes to Oceana Management Company. That's O-C-E-A-N-A, Ocean plus an A, Oceana Management Company, as from 1984, Oceana is. The suite number is 106-559. The street address is 4290 Bells Ferry Road, B-E-L-L-S-F-E-R-R-Y Road, Bells Ferry Road, in the notorious Kennesaw, Georgia, where everyone is required to own a gun, 30144. So a
spell
quick
that
repeat.
For me. Spell that.
Kennesaw,
spell that town.
K-E-N-N-E-S-A-W, Kennesaw, Georgia, 30144. Repeat the whole thing. Oceana Management Company, Suite 106-559, 4290 Bells Ferry Road is the street address in Kennesaw, Georgia, 30144. That's $2 only of pre-1965 coin lawful money, or $30 of counterfeit. And Red, and Terry, I sell it this way to point out the fraud in the money. I want to remind people of how their so-called dollars are dissipating every day, and that $30 price will not remain forever. The $2 lawful money will always remain constant, but it won't be long before we will have to charge you $40 in counterfeit, because that's what's happening to our so-called dollar in America.
Okay, I want to, I'm not sure what's happening here, but we're getting some strange background noise.
Oh, I can't hear it from here.
I see it's on the, it's BTR is doing something funny. Let's make sure I've got that address. You went through it even quick the second time. Oceana Management Company,
yep.
Suite 106-559.
Correct.
That's 4290 Bells Ferry Road, Kennesaw, Georgia, 30144.
Correct.
I have posted it in our chat room.
Oh, okay, super.
Well, what else would you like to talk about? We've got about 20 minutes left in the show. We skipped the break because I didn't want to take any time away from your discussion tonight. Is there anything you'd like to inform our listeners about that you got on your heart?
Well, I would urge them to look into American Free Press, which would be AmericanFreePress.net. Would be the fastest way to find it from people who are on the internet. But you know, we've been in publication trying to expose the truth for really since '91, when we are the later spotlight that's been in publication since '75. So we've been a long time exposing the truth about a situation. We are neither Republican nor Democrat. We're not left. We're not right. We are a populist publication. And you know, we found out a long time ago that a Bush can lie just as well as a Clinton. So it doesn't. We don't have any party labels, but we try to tell the truth about the situations that are going on. And I urge your listeners to just pull up AmericanFreePress.net or give them a call in Washington D.C. And that number from Hart would be 202-544-5977, and find out what they can do to subscribe to this weekly newspaper that gives some insight of what's going on. I just can't tell you how many letters to the editor we get every week who just praise us for being in business. Just thank us for telling them what's going on behind the scenes. So that is one thing that, you know, I'd like to point out is, you know, find out the truth of what's going on. Most of the scoop that I have, since I've been writing for them the last 15 years, and especially since the advent of the Internet, they're about the same time frame, most of the things that we learn and report on, at least that I research, come from Paris and London and Berlin news agencies and are almost never reported in the American press. And when they are, they're like a month or two behind us. And Red Beckman can certainly attest to that. The things that we've popped out with are not shown locally in your newspaper or even on your national TV for a month or two later. So I cannot urge people enough to support American Free Press. There are very few of us left in this country, and that us, by publications such as that, and they need your support because you're not going to learn the truth from your television talking heads, and I think most of your audience already knows this, or from Associated Press. So I urge you, check out AmericanFreePress.net, and as I say, I'm sure Red Beckman would concur.
Red?
I concur.
What else would you like to discuss
tonight? I think the story about LBJ, the very good fortune of Pat to run into LBJ's mistress,
Madeline Duncan Brown.
I thought that was really intriguing because that should have been in every tabloid in the country. The story about LBJ and his mistress, they like to print that type of stuff, but they didn't. I found that whole story rather intriguing because when I first heard about Kennedy's assassination, I was at the neighbors and helping them put up some hay. And somebody came out from the house. We were unloading hay. And somebody came out from the house, and I don't remember. I think they were crying when they came out there, and they said, "John F. Kennedy has just been shot and killed." And I just stopped dead in my tracks, and the first thing I thought, now who is benefiting from this terrible story? Who is benefiting by this? And, of course, it didn't take me but a couple of minutes to say LBJ would be the benefactor of that, because I knew a great deal about the Billy Saul Estes scam in Texas, and I knew that John F. Kennedy was going to hang Billy Saul Estes scam around LBJ's neck. at the next Democratic convention, and LBJ would be going down the road talking to himself. But LBJ got to be in the Oval Office by way of helping this terrible, terrible thing happen to our president.
You know, I interviewed briefly, 15, 20 minutes. I happened to meet Billy Saul Estes back around 2000 or so in Dallas. I was out there for the annual November 22nd week of the JFK Lancer meetings, and Billy Saul showed up this particular year, and I enjoyed chatting with him and made a nice rapport. Later, when I called him to get some stuff for publication, he put me off because he's writing his own book now. But indeed, there's no doubt that Billy Saul Estes had the goods on LBJ, as well as several others. Now, the woman you're speaking of was Madeline Duncan Brown. She became LBJ's paramour in 1948. She was a 23-year-old divorcee that Lyndon had met at a political party in Austin, and they immediately took a liking to each other and became lovers. Unfortunately for Lyndon, she became pregnant and gave birth to his illegitimate son in 1950. And this was, of course, in the 1950s, you can imagine what a bad deal that would be. So that was kept under the blanket for the rest of his whole career. But Madeline and I became friends much, much later, 1998, which is talked about in the book. But she gave me the whole historical details of that case. And she, when Lyndon realized the situation and how damaging it could be to his political career, he began to pay her $500 a week. A week in 1950s. Can you guys, I know Red's old enough to remember, but can you imagine how much money that was in the 1950s?
It was a lot of money.
Yeah, man. So Madeline was well taken care of, and she was provided for by one of Lyndon's undercover lawyers who brought her the cash every week to her house to take care of herself and her son. This continued through the 50s, through the 60s. Last time she saw him, she told me, was in 1969. And, of course, he died in early 73, as I remember, like January. And she told me that the week after that, the money cut off. A week after his death in January of 73, she never saw the lawyer again, and everything shut down. In 1986, her son Stephen, who had become suspicious over the years with his paternal history, asked his mother. She finally confessed because she thought she was dying at the time. She was sick in the hospital, and so she finally told him the truth about his father. He became very, very angry because he had suspected it for some time. Madeline told me, I'll digress a second, Madeline told me that in 1960, during the Kennedy-Johnson campaign, that she was in the lobby of the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas with a big political wing-ding going on, and Lyndon's sister, who was pretty outspoken, had a pretty big mouth. He later had her murdered, another story. But she wandered through the lobby, and here was Madeline with her, at that time, 10-year-old son, Stephen. And she said, "My, my, that boy sure does look like my brother." And Madeline decided, ooh, it might be a good time to get out of here. So she took her 10-year-old son and left because she didn't want too many people identifying that. But Anyhow, in 1986, when Stephen, who was, of course, a grown man, 36, going nearly 37 at the time, was going on, his mother had confessed to what had happened. This is when it made the headlines, you might remember, and this is when I had first heard of him. He had sued the Johnson estate. Lyndon had long been dead, but he had sued Lady Bird and the two daughters for his equal share of 1/4 of the Johnson estate, which would amount to about $10 million he had assessed at that time, or his lawyers had. And the case never got anywhere because he suddenly disappeared 3 months later after Madeline put a private detective on the case, found him in Washington, D.C., at the very notorious hospital where JFK, of course, had been autopsied and so many other things had gone on up there in D.C., in Bethesda Naval Hospital. But she had found him there, finally, dying of cancer, 37 years old. And she brought him home, and indeed, apparently he'd been injected with something. He never had any cancer problems before, but another one of those great mysteries and conspiracies. And Stephen died a couple of years later of cancer, so the suit, of course, died with him. But this is how they take care of their problems.
Red, we've got about 8 minutes left. Can you still hear me?
I can hear you. I think you ought to give Pat's address again, and I would recommend that Pat come up with a shorter address.
Oh, I know I've got to do that. Well, one shorter address, Red, is my website. I agree with you. It's patshannon.net. And they can get the mailing address there. They want to send me $2 in lawful money. They'll have to mail it. But we got PenPal at patshannon.net, www.patshannon.net. It's being repaired, so the website is still under construction, but at least you'll find the full mailing address there that we mentioned earlier, which, of course, was Unit 106-559, 4290 Bells Ferry Road, Kennesaw, Georgia, 30144. But if they don't have a pen tonight and want to just pull up at shannon.net, they can learn all that. And they will get an autographed copy. And, of course, a backup for this, if they don't want to remember that, all that is Tri-American Free Press, who's handling the book. They're the publisher. And they'll send you one as well. Of course, they are not geared for lawful money as I am, so they can only accept the counterfeit notes or your credit card.
I'm having some Skype connection problems, so Red, you may have to close this out.
Oh, you are sounding foggy. I noticed the difference.
Yeah. Well, Pat, it's good to have had you here on this program. You know, Walls in Our Minds is a little book that I wrote, and it's all the lies that have been believed by the American people is what has gotten them into trouble, the trouble that we're in today. And so we talk a great deal about truth on this program. And, your book, when WikiLeaks first hit the news, I said, well, boy, this is one of the things that's going to help bring down the federal god. And because I am convinced that the federal government, as we know it, has become a federal god, and it's in violation of the first and second commandments that you find in the scriptures, and Exodus 20, and God does not, he's a jealous God. He's the one that brought down the USSR, and he's going to bring down this government that we have, this federal God, is going to come down. And just when is anybody's guess, but it's going to happen. And I think that this book is going to play a part in that, in bringing the American people to a point where they recognize that they've been had, and they've made a mistake. And, you know, we've got to recognize, we've got to admit that we were wrong. We've been too lax. We haven't been vigilant and all, and we're paying a terrible price. So would you want to add something to that, Pat?
Well, I say praise the Lord that he could use this in that fashion. I certainly never dreamt that when I wrote it. I'm just trying to expose these lies that we've been dealt. And once again, everything goes back to the basic. The biggest lie, Red, as you well know, that we have ever bought is a phony Federal Reserve note. And, you know, as I tried to say earlier, any note, to be a bona fide note, must have a payor, it must have a payee. It must have a specified amount, and it must have a due date. Everyone who ever went down to the bank to borrow money for a car signed that kind of note. And here the so-called Federal Reserve notes we're passing around has none of that. It's only a token, and it doesn't purport to pay anything or have any value at all. And this is the elephant hiding in the living room that we have been so duped by. And everything, as I say in the opening chapter of my book, everything revolves around that. People tell me, what difference does it make whether we have gold or silver behind the coin or nothing else, as long as a grocer accepts it? Well, the difference is that the government cannot create gold or silver out of thin air, but they can certainly counterfeit paper. That's what's being done to us. And today, when the economists want to talk about the waste of taxpayers' money, I laugh in their faces, because how could taxpayers' money be created out of a trillion and a half of Obama's stroke of a pen? That's not taxpayers' money. It has not been since June of 24th, 1968, when they slammed the window on us. It is nothing but government money, and it's trash, and it is destroying everything that you and I as Americans ever stood for.
It reminds me of a story, a true story. There was a counterfeit, a fellow was caught counterfeiting Federal Reserve notes, and he was being prosecuted in San Diego for counterfeiting the dollars, the Federal Reserve notes. And there was one person on the jury that understood a lot of this, and so they had the guy cold. They'd caught him in the act, and so the prosecutor was so sure that he was going to have a conviction, but it didn't happen because the jury came out after some time and said not guilty. And the prosecutor just had a fit, of course. And so everybody on the jury, they're looking at this one fellow, the guy that had educated him. And so he takes a Federal Reserve note out of his billfold, and he goes down on the railing in front of the jury, and he spread it out on the railing, and he asked the prosecutor, he says, "How do you counterfeit a counterfeit?"
I love it.
And that was the end. There was no more said. Counterfeiting a counterfeit.
Yeah.
Which is reminds me of that story every time I read in the paper where somebody was picked up for counterfeiting.
Well, I know we're about to shut down, but you reminded me. I had Bruce McCarthy on my show last night, American Fruit Press's Hour, and Bruce always liked to point out that if the dollar is a measurement of gold, then how can you back a dollar with a dollar?
Yeah,
you can't back gold with gold.
Yeah, well, we've got the music background coming on, so until we talk again, Pat, while I get Volume 2 out. And,
okay, my friend. God bless you, Red Beckman. You're my hero. You always have been.
Oh, do what you can, which I know you'll do. And,
all right, thanks.
So
thanks for coming on, Pat.
Okay, I'm glad to be with you both. Thanks, Jerry. Bye-bye.
I'll say good night to everybody.
Good night, everyone.